From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when about 250 people came together in Rochester, people from government, business, nonprofit, faith-based, and education. They joined sixth grade students from the Genesee Community Charter School, and they challenged one another to do two things. First, take a look at the new ACT Rochester Annual Community Report Card. And second, combine the data with personal stories to put a human face on what's going on in our community. And the data, to be honest, is tough to hear. There are huge racial disparities. We've known that, but this report card helps crystallize the differences. For example, household incomes of white residents were nearly twice as high as those of African Americans and Hispanics in our community. And so, what can be done about that? Sometimes you have these big community meetings and everyone feels good about it and you go off on your way and nothing really happens. Well, what's going to make that different this time? What's causing the problems? Who's accountable? Our guest today will help us better understand the data and give us some ideas for how we might change it. In studio, we welcome back Ann Johnson, Senior Director for ACT Rochester at the Community Foundation. Ann, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And Simeon Bannister is Interim Vice President of Community Programs at the Community Foundation. Simeon, welcome back to you as well.
Great to be with you, Evan.
All right. Before we get to that, a brief hello from our colleague Veronica Volk, who's in studio. Hello.
Hi, Evan. I'm just here to remind everyone that we are in the middle of our spring pledge drive, and you can call right now if you're in the Rochester area, 454-6300, or toll-free 800-295-9994, or go to wxxi.org/give. Evan, we know a lot of people that are listening right now are not members, and if you are one of those people who is listening who appreciates this program, I just want to break down the fourth wall for a second. After the spring drive, we are going to get together and we're going to see how many resources we have to move forward with our reporting for shows like Connections so that Evan Dawson and Megan Mack can put together this great talk program. And we have a lot of really ambitious plans for the newsroom this year, and it's only possible if you help us out. So call right now, 454-6300 or 800-295-9994.
454-6300, the main number there. Thank you, Veronica.
Thanks, Evan.
As always, we'll talk to you a little bit later during these 2 hours. But now let's turn back to exactly why we're here this hour. And I'd like Ann and Simeon to remind us this community report card, how it's done, and then we're going to get into some of the meat of it because it is kind of tough to hear, I think. Mm-hmm. But Ann, tell us, this is seventh annual, so how do you do this?
Well, the community report card takes the 100 or so indicators that are on ACT Rochester, and they are what tell us how we're doing as far as quality of life. We build this major spreadsheet, and we actually compare our results as a region to how New York State is doing. The reason we do that is because we don't have our own targets. So the only way we can make a comparison as to we're better, worse, or the same is to look at New York City. Then we also look at trends based on the most recent year of data. So for instance, many of the trends go back to 2000, but if how we measure education indicators only goes back to 2013, then our trends would be done in that way. So we compile this regional report card and look at, you know, the picture. How many reds, how many greens, you know, where are we better or worse than New York State? And then we take it to the next level. We do one for each of the nine counties because we know each county wants to have their data to know how they compare.
And one of the things I always appreciate is that you put the report cards online on the community website, which is where?
ActRochester.org.
ActRochester.org. They're easy to find, and you can kind of sort and compare previous years. A little bit later this hour, I just grabbed a few things from a couple of years ago. I think we've established pretty well over the last few years that 12 months is a lot to ask to turn things around pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. 24 months is still not that long to change long-term trends, but it does start to give you a picture of where things might be going. So we're going to flag a couple of things there. Simeon, what stands out to you first and foremost? If you were in our journalistic shoes and you're writing a headline from this, what stands out to you?
I think a couple of things. I think the temptation for a lot of these kinds of reports is to go straight towards some of the negative items, likely because we know that that's a story that absolutely needs to be told. But there's some positive things too, Evan, that kind of stood out in this report for me. Lead poisoning in children is down 1.3%. Pre-K is up 22% over the last 10 or 15 years. Lower mortality rates, lower crime, teenage pregnancy down 2.2%. And I raise these because it tells us that when we're committed and we have the will, both political and otherwise, we can actually make changes in this community and we can make things better. And I think that's an important part of this narrative.
Yeah, that's the just a small example. I mean, not a small, just one example that Simeon just mentioned is something that I have highlighted right here. The rate of teen pregnancy dropped over the decade to 2.2% in our area, below the state, excluding New York City's rate, of 3.5%. And that is just a couple of years ago, it was right around 3%. So we're down from just under 3% down closer to 2%. And that's... that is a big drop. That's almost about a 30% drop in 2 years. And so then I wonder, Simeon, and that's just one example. We're going to look at other indicators. Mm-hmm. Most of the indicators, as I saw them, are going in a slow but what we would call a good direction. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take time. But then how do you start to figure out what's happening to change that? Because that's important too, right?
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. And there's some real interesting opportunities that, frankly, are underway in the community to start looking even deeper, to start answering the questions around what's behind the changes. And it's everything from Rock the Future. Certainly our MAPI is engaged in that kind of work, where folks are starting to interrogate. So we've got these numbers and we've got the data, but what's happening? But here's the thing, Evan. There was a time in this community where we didn't have the data. There was a time in this community where data was siloed and segmented and spread all over. So again, here's a positive narrative around something that's happening right here in Rochester that we're now working in a way that's informed by numbers. And that's an important element to add. I'll give you just kind of some stories around what's behind some of the data. I mean, I remember back in the early 2000s, talk about the lead numbers when the Coalition to Prevent Lead Poisoning came together. And it's a group of folks that have really had their kind of shoulder to the wheel for well over a decade. And we're starting to see the benefit of that, concerted community effort. Pre-K was a huge decision that was made both at the federal and state level that's shown itself here in Rochester. And frankly, what's known kind of colloquially as the Rochester model folks identify Rochester as one of the highest performing early childhood communities across the country. That's an important narrative to tell. And it's also important because it provides us with a unique opportunity to look at something that is happening in this community between early pre-K and then K and then 1, 2, 3 and then, the kind of K to 12 spectrum. We know that we've got a good start. So now what do we need to do to have that kind of continuity? These are questions that we can ask now in ways that we couldn't before because we're data informed.
Even registering to vote. Mm-hmm. 82% of regional residents were registered a couple of years ago, 79%. So all of the little indicators, not all of them, but a lot of little indicators are step by step, at least trending in a better direction. But Anne, I go back to, again, I laughed when he said it, but I remember so well when somebody called when our MAPI, when the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty mm-hmm. Initiative started, and Ed Doherty had written the poverty report that a lot of people were kind of keying in on, mm-hmm. and he was on this program, and someone called in and said, what's one thing we all can do that will help change things in just a year? And he said, stop asking how to flip poverty in 1 year. That would be great. That'd be a great way to start. But sometimes it takes 1 or 2% or percentage points mm-hmm. a year to get to the point where in 5 or 10 years, it's significant. Mm-hmm. And are we at least, I don't want to give you a softball. I want you to give me your honest mm-hmm. assessment. Does this add up to at least a better regional direction in poverty, in approach to jobs and opportunity? Mm-hmm. Is there enough there that tells you we've got small incremental steps, but at least things may be working?
So for the last 8 years running ACT, I have rarely talked about the fact that the acronym means achieving community targets. I think for the first time in the last 8 years, the momentum of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, the Rock the Future initiatives, both collective impact, who need to look at how measures are evaluated and how we go forward. I think for the first time as a community, we're ready to start looking at results-based accountability. And if you don't have that, I can do 8, 9, and 10 report cards over these next few years, but there won't be an understanding, as you asked Simeon, of what's driving it. Or, for instance, what isn't? So if we're moving forward doing good things to move certain people out of poverty, I've heard several times you've had Hilda Escher Rosario on the program, and we are a welcoming community for people from Puerto Rico. But how do we know if the number doesn't move that by welcoming these families in and helping them get traction may impact our poverty number for a year or two? Because they're, you know, so what we really need to understand is every initiative, how it's impacting those things that we want to call priorities. Because, you know, when you try to work on everything, nothing gets done.
Yeah, I think that's well said. Here's an important one when we look at some of those small changes. 2 years ago, child poverty reached 52% over a rolling five-year period. It's at 50%. Mm-hmm. It's a staggering number, and a lot of that concentrated in the city. A lot of that concentrated among families of color. But again, a small incremental move in what we would call a better direction. But tied to this, to me, is that big story of why incomes, you know, white households average almost twice the number for households that are African-American or Latino. And Simeon, I want to ask you directly, if we think we know why that is, does that accountability... I mean, is it spread out? Can employers impact more than they maybe realize? What do you think?
Sure. I think absolutely. One thing I want to say, just kind of dovetailing on Anne's point really quickly, is that I think it's also important for us to recognize that these problems were long in the making. Mm-hmm. And so it's reasonable to expect then that the solutions are going to take some time. We celebrate these incremental, you know, quote, wins, if you will, while recognizing that there's still far too many people that are suffering in our community with an obligation to do something about it. In terms of your question, Evan, I think it strikes me that we have some fundamental issues in our community that we need to continue to deal with. Number one, there is a perception, I think, that continues to rankle not just our community, but our country in general, that this is a zero-sum game, right? That if certain people start to achieve progress, then that means that others aren't. And the fact is that there's all kinds of research and data, again, why it's important to have access to these kinds of numbers, that demonstrate that, in fact, when we have equity, we have more regional vibrancy and more regional vitality. And in fact, many of the communities that across the country that are doing the best economically are the places that have embraced diversity, are the places that have realized that we all float with the rising tide. And so in this community, it seems to me that so much of the bias is driven by, in some ways, this perception that we've got to, you know, protect some folks that have won for a long time, and that's at the cost of those that haven't. And so let me give you a couple of quick examples of what I mean. A lot of people, there's some segments in this community that would decry our high taxes, right? The tax, particularly county taxes, they would decry our high taxes. Well, here's the thing, right? If we have equity, particularly in our education system, and folks get good, solid educations that prepare them for career success, then folks don't have to, you know, utilize social services, which is a big cost driver for the county. And so even in that space, equity shows itself again, that if you want lower taxes, then maybe you want to try a little equity. Business attraction. I was recently at the GRE investors meeting, and there was some discussion around engaging businesses outside of our community to come here. Mm-hmm. And a big consideration is talent in the region. If we've got 30% of the population sitting on the economic sideline, makes us less attractive, which impacts our community's vitality and our community's attractiveness. Better business starts. That if you want, there's just a mountain of research that demonstrates that businesses that have diverse participation have better ideas, better products, better marketing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So again, where you have equity, you have vibrancy. And I think that's the message that folks in our community really need to start to grasp, that that's the way that we start to change this. And so I would encourage hiring managers all across, you know, the community. Hey, listen, equity is going to help your business. That ought to be a focus, not a, you know, kind of a throwaway. We need to, you know, get a few folks in here that are from a different background, but that it's a critical element for business success. And I think if folks realize that, then we'd start to see the kind of changes in our community.
I want to follow up with Simeon, but I know Anne wants to jump in. So go ahead, Anne. I know you have something to add there. Go ahead.
One of the biggest ahas for me when we put out the report, Hard Facts, was the example that Ed Doherty put into the report that said, in our city of Rochester, if our Black and Latino residents were making money at the same level, so if their income was at the same level of their New York counterparts, so that's
New York State.
New York State, yeah. Counterparts, apples to apples, the poverty rate in the city would drop 7 percentage points, so from 33 to 26, mm-hmm. and we would go from being ranked fourth worst in the country in poverty to 17th. That is huge. That shows that there is an opportunity for us to do more, and yet I don't think we know exactly what that is. But how can we be so different in this arena than the rest of New York State as a whole?
Well, let's start with the thread that Simeon is putting together for us, and when we talk about hiring and from the employer perspective. So a couple of things here. First of all, I want to know how you view hiring and employers in 2018 in context of our history. And by that I mean, we know in the 40s, 50s, 60s in particular, this community, like many American communities and many American northern communities in particular, had an ugly history of racism. You know, Black families moving up from the South thinking about jobs and opportunities, trying to get away from overt, terrible racism, hoping for those opportunities, and either denied jobs altogether, redlined, all kinds of fraud and discrimination that happened very overtly. Well, today, if white families or white households are making twice on average, is it less overt but still similar to you, or is it a different sort of construct?
Well, I think I want to reframe that a little bit. I think, you know, what's interesting is that look at what that history has gotten us, right? I mean, you know, and I think what really is important here to establish is that for some reason, folks think that, you know, poverty is a problem only for those that are impoverished. And the fact is that poverty is a problem for all of us. And the reason why it's a problem for all of us is that it short circuits, again, our regional vitality. And so if we want to be a region that is attractive and vibrant and growing, then it calls on us to have equity. Why? Because the history shows us that when we embrace inequity as a community, look where it led us. It was fatalistic. And so I would just pitch to, you know, the listening audience that it's just time for us to try something different. I mean, just, you know, if we keep doing the same thing over and over again, the cliche, of course, is that that is the definition of insanity.
Can I press on that? Because I'm thinking about bubbles and the way we are the members of our community can be insulated from bad outcomes, from pain. Right now, we still have a world where if you have enough of a resource or a money, your lifestyle, mm-hmm. you can still live in a community that looks mostly like you and be pretty well insulated from it. But the argument you're making is that you're still going to be hurt, or at least many of us are still going to be hurt mm-hmm. beyond just a core group of people who are living in poverty. Help us see how.
Look at every Rust Belt city in the country. I mean, right? When you look at the levels of competitiveness, our regions are held back by populations of folks that have not had access to resources. And ultimately, that lack of access to resources shows itself in expenditures that we all have to make, because as a community and as a society, we have rightfully made the decision that we won't just, you know, completely leave folks behind. Which means that, again, it's higher expenditures for taxes, it's higher expenditures for healthcare, it's higher expenditures right on down for transportation, right on down the line. And so if we want to lower those costs and lower those expenditures, then that means that we need to equitably distribute resources in the first instance. And so, again, that's what I'm saying to folks is, you know, if we think about a different way of operating that is at this point a necessity, because you can see it whether it's here in Cleveland and Akron and Michigan and so on and so forth. We can see where, you know, where bad choices of the past have reared their head. That, for example, insular, you know, thinking and holding resources with a select few has left out the many. And then that shows itself in a region where when those select few have some hard times, you know, vis-a-vis
or their kids
Kodak across the street, or their kids do, you know, look what happens, right? That we've got these major major businesses that fall on hard times because of lack of competitiveness. I would potentially make the argument that maybe we would have been more competitive if we had some diversity in those boardrooms and we had had some diversity of thought and we had anticipated some of the changes that were coming down the road. And so because we didn't, then, you know, large institutions, frankly, have failed. And because they failed, then it has ramifications for the entire community. And so, you know, again, what I'm pitching is that we just take a different, you know, a different tact. And I think the Community Foundation, which I am just, you know, thrilled to be a part of an organization that's really focused on these issues, has identified, you know, a pathway that builds on the intellectual resources that we have in the community, that then says, hey, what assets do we have in the community? How do we strengthen those assets across the community? How do we then look at the way that those assets are distributed through systems and then impact those systems in meaningful ways? Systems are guided by leaders, so we need diverse, thoughtful leaders that are leading our systems. And then finally, we secure those changes in policy, and that's how we kind of lock in the benefits that we can achieve. And so if we infuse that pathway with equity through every step, I suspect that that's going to be beneficial. And again, the evidence is there to prove it. There's an organization out of Washington, D.C. called Policy Link. And they have, you know, done some really, really awesome research showing how communities that become equity focused have just taken off across the country. Our data is the first step to becoming informed around what we are either accomplishing or not accomplishing. And it's a real testament to Ann and to Ed and, you know, certainly our partners at United Way, who joined us at the outset of ACT. It's a real testament that folks had the vision to bring a resource like this to the community so that we could know what's happening today and start the process of in a data-informed way and knowledge at our fingertips to then start making those improvements.
Jay emails the program and wants to know if your guest is calling for quotas in hiring, and he says, by the way, I hope he is.
Yeah. So I don't know. You know, it's interesting. I mean, I think that in many ways what I'm calling for is folks to challenge their own bias, right? And to ask some real deep questions around when candidates come in, for example, are we denying candidates because they are not, quote, socialized to the way that, you know, we're used to doing things or because of merit? And I think that if we, you know, are honest with ourselves and we really start to embrace, you know, what's on the paper, the merit, that we would start to see some of the changes. And I've seen it in, you know, in other parts of my own life and places, other places that I've worked, that, you know, we've got to kind of, you know, challenge our normal way of doing business. And by, you know, by challenging it, that, you know, hopefully that results in, you know, more diverse practices. I don't know if, you know, if quotas are the right answer, because we want to make sure they're, you know, you've got good fit and all that stuff. But I do absolutely believe that we've got to look ourselves in the mirror and ask some hard questions.
All right. So listeners, let me appeal to you. Do you see diversity where you work? Should you see more of it? What about the structure of your management? And what about the hiring practices? Is it discussed at all? Can we do better? Can we achieve more equity, as Simeon Bannister says, when it comes to our workforce? And how do you see it playing out wherever you are? 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Ann Johnson, Senior Director for ACT Rochester at the Community Foundation. It was a few years ago that Bob Duffy over at the Rochester Chamber of Commerce directed a challenge to local businesses, not on the basis of race, but on the basis of income. He challenged them to hire, at least for the summer, and I think permanently if possible, at least in the next year, he said, one person who's living in poverty, at least one. And I never heard much come of that, and that was sort of a small challenge. And I even heard some HR directors say, well, there's certain questions we can't ask. And, you know, I mean, you can't tell us to do that. And there was some pushback a little bit. I wonder if directly challenging business, what was it like when you got together with 250 members of the community, with sixth graders at the charter school? I mean, there were business leaders there. Are they feeling, do they actually grab onto this and agree with this, or what are they saying?
So I'd say the population that has been slowest to learn and understand that ACT Rochester exists has been the business community. But I happened to be walking around talking to, listening to the table discussions. And at one of the tables was a business executive who has done multiple positions in different organizations in Rochester. And he's like, I never knew this existed. So I think one of the challenges, because we're now starting to use data the way businesses want us to, is to engage them. And I don't think you should set quotas, but since the Hard Facts report came out, I've actually been asking people to take a look at their demographics, to actually look, whether it's your church, the place you worship, where you're involved in extracurricular activities, but take a look at what's the board look like? What does senior leadership look like? And really, you know, look at that diversity, because unless you're aware, and many of us who are privileged because we're white don't have to look at that, and we don't think about it. And we want people to consciously think about it. You can make a decision. You can make a decision not to take action. But if you see where your people and the demographics of the people you're working with fall, then you could put programs in place to drive that. And the reason, Evan, that I put this together is we talk about structural racism. And there are three main pillars of it. One is public policy. ACT Rochester can influence that someone may drive public policy, but I can't walk the talk. There's organizational practices. Again, I might be able to make some suggestions to the foundation of something they do because I sit there. But the one that ACT could do is say, let's use data. Let's look at what your organization looks like. Be aware of it and decide if you're going to take conscious effort. Now, if our community did this en masse, whoa, wouldn't I love to say, let's see if we can move those needles to be more diverse by 2% in 2 years. But that's the cart before the horse. First, people have to want to know and look at themselves.
All right, let me get Joyce in Rochester on the phone who wants to weigh in on this. Go ahead, Joyce.
Hi, it seems to me there is a missing demographic, and that's the wide range of people of Asian heritage. Are they classified somewhere else when these studies are done?
I'll let our guest from ACT Rochester. Oh, you want to turn the could you hear, Ann?
No.
There's a volume knob right there. Ann, right here. Take a look. There you go. There you go. Joyce, do the question again,
Thank
and
you.
Ann can hear you better. Go ahead.
Yes, I think there is a missing demographic, and that is the wide range of people of Asian heritage. Where do they fit into these studies?
Okay, I'll let her. Thank you, Joyce. I'll let our guest from ACT Rochester respond. Ann?
So when Ed Doherty put the Hard Facts report together for us, he looked at the larger populations. And because we were doing this for the 9-county region, what we found is that white, African-American, and Latino, so the ethnicity of Latino and the races of African-American and white, were the highest predominance. In the reports, we pointed out that the others did not have the significant populations throughout the region. They do absolutely in Rochester. And on our website, where we look at every indicator by race and ethnicity, we do include Asian. It just wasn't at the highest level to make a difference in the reporting that we were doing based on covering the 9-county region.
Okay. And, you know, Simeon, when it comes up, when we were looking across different boundaries as we understand population groups in this country, I occasionally hear that question. Well, mm-hmm. Are you leaving out certain groups? How do you respond to that?
Yeah, there's a theoretical approach that describes what's called the black-white dyad and says that the relationship between primarily between black people and white people in this country has subsumed the discussion for other either races, ethnicities, and so on and so forth. And there's some legitimacy to that argument. And so I think that there's certainly a cognizance. I mean, the data is certainly tracked. It's on the ACT Rochester website. That said, for us to make kind of the most significant gains, particularly in this community, we have decided to look at the populations that have been, frankly, the most afflicted. And in this community, that happens to be non-white Latinos and our Latinx. and African-American folks.
All right. So if you want to take a look at the community report card for the 9-county region for 2018, ACT Rochester has it online. We will link to it for you. You just heard Simeon Bannister, Interim Vice President of Community Programs at the Community Foundation, and Ann Johnson, Senior Director for ACT Rochester at the Community Foundation. I got to get our only break, and I'm going to come back to some of your emails. You want to call the program? I see the phone ringing. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Coming up in our second hour, Listen to Your Mother is coming back to Rochester. The annual production brings together a cast of moms sharing their real-life personal stories. And we're going to hear from some of the cast of 2018 and previous years, sharing their stories about parenting through loss, challenge, and more. Listen to Your Mother next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's go ahead and grab Bill in Rochester, and then we'll get some of your emails in. Go ahead, Bill.
Hi, guys. Hey, I was just wondering if the panel is using disparate impact theories to conclude that there are some organizations that have racist hiring practices.
Can you explain more what you mean by that?
Are you familiar with disparate impact?
Not enough that I could speak fluently about it, so why don't you tell us more about it?
Okay. I believe what that is it looks at the demographics of a group of individuals and matches that with the demographics of a community. And if the demographics aren't relatively close, it's then presumed that maybe some decisions are made based on race rather than merit.
Okay. And you're so
is that your understanding of it?
Well, I'm not all that familiar with the concept, though.
You're not familiar with disparate impact.
Well, I mean, not the term, but the idea that you're presenting. I am. And so, but why don't you kind of crystallize that into a point? Are you concerned that that if a community is doing X on a whole, but a population within that community is doing Y, and Y is a lesser outcome or a worse outcome for lived experience, that the concern is that the Y group is responsible for their own outcome, or is I'm trying to understand what the concern is, or where you're
I'm just trying to understand if that's a method that they're using. The definition of it is in the U.S. labor laws. Refers to practices in employment, housing, and other areas that adversely affect one group of people over a protected characteristic more than another, even though rules applied by employers or landlords are formally neutral.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead, Simeon.
Yeah, so I think I know where you're coming from, and I think what I'm asking you to do, Bill, is to even be more expansive in your thinking. So Evan's coverage on education is a good example of, I think, what you're describing, right, which is that a lot of school districts say, hey, listen, we are like all in on diversifying our teacher forces, but we just can't find teachers of color. We can't find, you know, teachers with diverse backgrounds. And so while we're all in, hey, you know, we're doing the best that we can, but we can't, you know, make it up out of nowhere, right?
Sure.
And so which is to say that it wouldn't necessarily be bias in that case. What would actually be happening there is that there's just, you know, a paucity or a dearth of those teachers. What I'm saying to you, Bill, is that let's take it even further back. Why aren't there enough teachers, right? Why aren't there enough people that are going into education? And what is it about the systems that we've created where we know that we've got, you know, unemployment in this community that still, you know, as a function of what's happening nationally, still lags behind the state and the nation, where, you know, teaching, hey, it's a pretty good profession, you know, you get a decent pension and, you know, and all that kind of stuff, right? So what is happening in this community systemically that prevents people from going down that road? And I would, you know, contend that when we have an education system, and again, this isn't to ascribe any blame, but that's failing, you know, our community, and not just the kids in the system, but it's failing our community, right? That's the reason why we don't have enough folks going through. And so that calls on us to then ask some tough questions and make some tough choices as a community. And so I'm asking for us to not just look at, you know, let's not be, you know, kind of an inch deep here. Let's go even deeper, right? Let's go really deep to start asking those questions. And the cool thing about it is that we can do that in a data-informed way. We don't just have to kind of, you know, stick our thumb in the air, but act Rochester and other resources give us a chance to do that.
Well, I would absolutely agree that urban education needs to be reformed because it's a travesty. We've lost multiple generations over the last 40 years, I bet, because of poor education in urban areas, particularly in Rochester.
So I'm going to challenge you one way here, Bill. I wouldn't say that just urban education is broken. I would say education, broadly speaking, is broken, right? Because even though perhaps in suburban districts we see, you know, high test scores, if folks aren't, you know, getting a historically accurate education, that's problematic. Mm-hmm. If folks aren't having exposure to people that look different from them, that's problematic. And so I would actually argue that education across the board is fundamentally broken, and that there's some interventions that we ought to be considering to rectify that.
And if you look at a barrier that is keeping what Simeon described from happening, if you look at housing, that's a huge challenge because 50% of all rental units in Monroe County are in the city of Rochester. And even the rental units that are affordable housing outside of the city are typically for senior citizens. And so that availability of rental properties is one challenge. The second thing is HUD says you're not supposed to spend more than 30% of your income on rent. And when our people that we know, people of color in the city, are spending up to 50% of their income on rent, it's that cycle that you can't get out of. How do I have time to go back to school, to do more, to pay my rent, to put money aside, to get ahead, to move to the suburbs? It's like, you know, there's the education piece, then there's the being where you might want to be.
Want to follow up one more time? Go ahead. Yeah.
I think a good way to address the education would be to introduce more school choice with vouchers and the like. I think that would give families more opportunities to send kids to schools that could do better for them.
All right, well,
Eva Moskowitz wrote a great book, The Education of Eva Moskowitz. She runs a charter school that I think is called the Success Academy in New York, New York City. I think it would be a great model to follow. Or, you know, like the Kipp schools or Jeffrey Canada schools. In Harlem, I think those would be great places to start.
All right, so one more thing on this, Bill, and I want Simeon to address this because Simeon is not only with the Community Foundation, but with the Henrietta School Board and has worked in education matters consistently. So let me ask you on this, Bill. When you talk about school choice and vouchers, if you're rating your confidence that that's a good idea on a scale of 0 to 100, where do you put your confidence that that's the right thing to do?
Well, it's a hard thing to grade, but all I know is I did see this film called Waiting for Superman. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. Well, that certainly depicted school choice as a pretty effective tool to be used to reform education and urban education specifically.
The reason I asked the 0 to 100, because I think it's helpful to know if you're at least leaving a window open to be persuaded or at least look at data that might conflict with some of the ideas that you have. You're not an absolutist.
Correct.
Very good.
I certainly think that there's a lot of data that supports that. I think you can even go to Louisiana and New Orleans, where they've had to rebuild the schools after Katrina, and they've had a lot of success with vouchers there. So I just think there's a lot of data out there that supports that.
All right, Bill, as always, thanks for the phone call. I'm going to let Simeon answer. I've got to get to other calls and emailers. And as always, thanks for being open-minded to the discussion. Now, he's talking about vouchers. He's talking about school choice. What do you think, Simeon?
Yeah. So, my school board service is actually coming to its close. But that notwithstanding, I think the challenge that we have in our community, again, is to be innovative and to be thoughtful. And so certainly, you know, that means fleshing out any opportunities, any options that are on the table. I do think it's important to note, though, that there's this, you know, kind of presumption that that competition is like the ultimate panacea for every problem. And while, you know, in certain instances, competition is certainly, a motivator and can certainly be beneficial, it does also introduce some perverse incentives. And I think that's one of the things that we've got to be, you know, really dogged about. Talk a little bit about the charter school space. This is not certainly university applied. There are certain instances where we've seen, folks you know, do some things that were a little shady. But then there also are institutions that are doing great stuff and that are providing a wonderful education and that should share some of those techniques with public education. I think the other problem that we just need to be conscientious of is that a wholesale solution, and what happens to the schools that don't perform? You know, you say, well, they get closed. Well, then what happens to the students that are in those schools? And so I think, you know, there's some, we don't go too far down the rabbit's hole. That being said, that is a rabbit hole that Rock the Future and others are going down, and they're doing it, again, in a data-informed way that's really important. And I would encourage you, Bill, to maybe connect up with those folks to even become a little bit more informed.
All right. A lot of, if you're on the phone, a lot of phone calls and emails. I want to get through as many as we can, so we're going to keep it moving. If you're on the phone, stay there. I will get to you. Don on Twitter pointing out again, this is a nine county report? So this is a nine county report. And he says, towns outside Rochester can be very white. Caledonia is 95% white, for example. Should we expect companies and organizations there to reflect the community and be 95% white, or should they try to be more diverse?
So I want to say this, you know, this, and this is, you know, so then kind of circling back around to the quota conversation. So there is no quota that I'm aware of today, perhaps it was in the past, but there's no quota that I'm aware of today that preserves, that says that a certain number of white people need to be hired for pretty much any business that I'm aware of. Yet that happens, you know, quote unquote, naturally. And I think that's what we need to interrogate, right? That, you know, fundamentally, what I'm arguing for is not, you know, an imposition, but that folks should see the benefit of having a diverse, workforce. And as I said, there's a mountain of research. And if there's anybody interested, you know, feel free to give me a ring or whatever, and I'll point you to it. But there's a mountain of research that shows that businesses that are diverse are more competitive and they do a better job. And so, you know, take it for what it's worth. I think that that's something that people ought to want to pursue, and they shouldn't be mandated, imposed, and, you know, forced to or anything like that. It just seems to me that, you know, it's a smart business decision.
All right. So is it fair to say that in Caledonia, if a business or an organization is 95% white, it might be technically reflective of the community, but you think might be susceptible to pitfalls that more diverse companies or organizations would not be susceptible to?
I do. And I think that, you know, they should, you know, if I was running a business in Caledonia, I would say to myself, gee, in order for my business to be as competitive as it possibly can, maybe this is some diversity is something I need to think about.
And Dave emails to say, rather than, and this is Dave is an emailer who wants to see things change in the same direction our guests do. Dave says, rather than quotas, business owners, myself included, need to incorporate blinded resume review when hiring, redacting demographic info from resumes before reviewing them. How do we feel about that? Ann, Simeon?
I think that's a great idea. I think it moves in the right direction and gives you a first pass at not deciding who you will look at based on their name or demographic information.
Okay, is that aspirational, or does that do? Is there data that I don't know? I don't have any data in front of me on blinded hiring, and I wish I did. And I'm going to look into that. So, Dave, thank you for that email. Simeon, does that feel aspirational or really kind of a good practice?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, like I said, I would pitch that, you know, being intentional about having diverse candidates is a good thing. That's, you know, that's my perspective. But I think anything that allows us to be able to step back from the practices that allow bias into the process is generally a good thing. And so I would say, you know, what we've seen historically in this country is a very virulent strain of bias that has, you know, kept people from having access to opportunity. And that strain has undercut our capacity to be competitive, both as a country, as a community, and even for the individual firms.
All right, let's get Mike and Brad on the phone. Mike first. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, a lot of the ideas talked about kind of tie in with the 2% or the incremental improvement. But one thing that I haven't heard talked about that I think could result in quicker, stronger improvement on this and other areas is the rate of small business, minority-owned businesses that have started, increase the capital. Do the statistics reflect anything on those topics?
And Simeon?
Well, I'll tell you something that's interesting. So if you think of a lot of entrepreneurs, so this is the way that the legacy of racism continues to show itself, right? So if you look at a lot of entrepreneurial ventures that have been successful in our community, many of those were spin-outs from the old, you know, the big firms, right? So it was folks that were in niche areas in Kodak or niche areas in Bausch & Lomb and other firms. And as those companies, you know, met their demise, they were innovative and spun out into entrepreneurial activities. Evan established at the outset that in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s that we had these issues, 90s today, frankly, that with these issues around bias. And so that means then that the same patterns of disparity that were evident in the hiring practices at firms is now evident in the entrepreneurial ventures that have spun out.
Mike, you want to follow up there?
Yeah, and you know, I get it. That makes sense. But if we're trying to chart changes, are we charting the access to capital or the small business creation? And it doesn't have to be, you know, like a spinoff of Kodak. Mm-hmm. What about somebody in the skilled trades? Instead of working for someone else, mm-hmm. we ID them and give them access to capital mm-hmm. so they can have their own landscape electrician. You know, I mean, there's some value to be mined here. Granted, I understand your point, but I think it's a missed opportunity.
Well, no, I actually agree with you, and actually the Community Foundation agrees with you as well. One of the exciting areas that we're exploring, because empowerment is a big part of this as well, right? That in addition to, you know, the kind of hiring piece, empowering communities that have historically been disenfranchised is also an important element that we need to consider. The Community Foundation recently approved a policy to engage in what's called mission-related investment, and a big part of our policy focuses on entrepreneurship and on driving capital and driving opportunity into communities where that hasn't always been the case, so that folks can determine their own path forward. But again, one of the interesting challenges is I think you are very insightful as it relates to looking at some of the skilled trades and some of those areas. But we have to make sure that that is accompanied by access, because people have to have a place to learn skills, right? So, I mean, I can't just start a business because I want to start a business. I have to have an idea. I have to have the skills that have been developed and all that kind of stuff. And so there's some work that this community has to do to make sure that people that have been shut out from those opportunities get access on a fair basis. And I think that's really what folks are pushing for.
All right, I want to get one more phone call in. Brad in Rochester has been waiting. Go ahead, Brad.
Yes. I don't think anybody's actually talked about what I call the general generational apathy towards education. I may have my numbers wrong, but last I heard, truancy rates in Rochester schools are like 50%. And basically, graduation rates are right around the same number. There's not going to be any uplifting if kids don't go to school. You can have as many teachers as you want in school, but if half the classroom is empty and a good percentage of those that show up don't even speak English very well, we're not going to get any further ahead than we are right now.
All right, so let me give you just a few numbers as I have them, and I'll let our guests respond there, because I'm glad you brought up education. What we are seeing is a higher enrollment in the last several years in pre-K, so now 44% of the four-year-olds in the region, according to this report card, are enrolled in pre-K. That's less than the 52% statewide number, but that's up 4 percentage points in 2 years' time. And 37% of third graders in the region passed the state's reading test, below the state's 43%. That's a problem, but it was 8 percentage points worse 2 years ago. Math is sort of stagnating or going backwards a little. So there's a 41% regional math passing rate compared to 45% a couple of years ago. So that's sort of a strange one. Four-year high school graduation rate for the region, 85%. And that's up from 84% 2 years ago, 57% in the city of Rochester, up from 53% a couple of years ago. So those are some of the numbers. Got a couple of minutes left. I'll let both of our guests respond there on what education is doing, because he thinks that this conversation missed some of that. Go ahead.
So several things that have been happening that will improve the pipeline of success. Three-year-olds in the city of Rochester are able to attend pre-K now free, and about half of the three-year-olds have been taken advantage of this in the last year. As part of that effort, these children will be screened. So if they have problem seeing or hearing loss, they will be identified early, and so those children have a better chance to progress successfully, even if the three-year-old is not part of the pre-kindergarten, they can still have the same assessment done. The school district is also starting to look at, let's not wait until our students are in 10th or 11th grade to be sure that they've got the credits necessary to graduate. So one of the measures they're looking at is, are our 9th graders getting that 5.5 credits before they leave 9th grade so that we don't find out that they're behind to begin with? And they're looking at first and second grade proficiency with reading so they don't get to 3rd grade and find out we can't read to learn because we didn't learn to read. So there's the behind-the-scenes numbers that ACT doesn't report on that I feel are driving to move things in a much better direction.
Okay, go ahead, Timmy.
The other exciting piece here, I mean, this is a place where kind of where we started with some positive signs. You know, there are some good things that are happening. The foundation worked with Rosemary Rivera, some other partners with the community task force to change some of the school climate that's been going on in the school district. It's led to a significant number in the drop in the number of suspensions. That's a good piece of news. Our president and CEO, Jennifer Leonard, was the first chair of Rock the Future. That's Jackie Campbell. It's its current executive director. We're informed by their work. Good things are happening in this community. Positive signs are happening. It's incremental. But if we can all realize that we all benefit by having a more equitable community and do our part, I think that that's going to lead us to a much more sustainable and vibrant future.
If you want to take a look at the report, we'll have it for you online in our various platforms. And I want to thank our guests from ACT Rochester and the Community Foundation. Ann Johnson, always nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good to see you too. Thanks.
And Simeon Bannister, let's do this more often. Thank you. Good to have you. Let's get a short break and more connections coming up.